Today is the 458th celebration of the Festival of the Reformation, and we have the pleasure of having in our studio with us the Reverend Dr. Lewis W. Spitz, Jr. of Stanford University, a graduate of Concordia Seminary, also a graduate of Harvard University, and the writer of quite a few books on the 16th century, and that's what we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes on KFUO. Welcome to KFUO, Dr. Spitz.
Why, thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be here. Sort of a homecoming for me, since I did get my Bachelor of Divinity degree here and spend a number of years at Concordia. I'm glad to be back with all of you.
It seems that quite a few people who have been students here have had some experience down here at this end of the campus, too.
It's true. Yes, I was at one point an assistant to Dr. Walter E. Meyer, the Lutheran Hour speaker, and spent a little time in this studio getting things ready for him.
Let's talk a little bit about the 458th celebration of the Festival of the Reformation. First of all, perhaps it would be best to go back to the 16th century and talk a little bit about the context of the Reformation. Why was the Reformation successful with Martin Luther and his other cohorts or followers at Wittenberg, where it was unsuccessful, the many various attempts in the centuries before the 16th century?
Mm-hmm. That's a probing question that really invites at least a 50-minute lecture. But as brief as a historian or a professor can be, I think that there's been an entirely new evaluation of this question of the success of the Reformation in recent scholarship. It used to be the habitual way of explaining the causal nexus, to explain it all in terms of sort of socio-economic unrest, and this seemed to be in temper with the secular spirit of the times. But in recent research, the fact that for a century and a half prior to Luther's time, there was a tremendous increase of religious fervor and religious interest. This is just almost opposite of the earlier explanation that during the Renaissance there was a great growth of secularization and the church was thereby weakened and fell quickly to Luther's criticism. But rather the fact that there was this tremendous increase of interest in religion explains why Luther, with the fervor of his gospel and the renewal of the basic Christian message, had such tremendous impact upon at least half of Europe, and indirectly on the other half, because of the stimulation of the Catholic Reformation in turn.
Would you view this gospel discovery of Martin Luther as a new discovery that had never been in the church before, or is it kind of a reawakening of something very old to Christianity?
Luther himself never considered himself to be an innovator in any sense. When he asked himself the question in Latin, it's nam tu solus opus, are you alone wise? He always answered it with, but I am not alone. And that many people in the whole history of the Christian church had been emphasizing the gospel just as he had. And he liked to associate himself with this more evangelical tradition throughout the history of the church. So when people said, such as Denifla, that Luther was not an innovator, Luther would have agreed with them. He was more, well, you know, Schlegel called a historian a prophet looking backward, and in a sense Luther was looking both ways, looking backward toward this evangelical tradition and forward to the world that he hoped to reform.
So, in a sense, Lutheran history dates back to the earliest times of the church, unlike what we sometimes think, that Lutheran history somehow started in the 16th century and has only mm-hmm. been in existence for 458 years.
Sure, I'm sure you saw that wonderful little Peanuts cartoon, which showed the little girl writing a history of the church and Charlie Brown's girlfriend, and she's saying, when you write church history, you have to start at the beginning. Our pastor was born in the year 1930, and actually, of course, the church is nearly 2,000 years old.
Would you consider the evangelical reawakening, then, of Luther's theology the main discovery that, or the main contribution that Luther made to the church?
I'm quite convinced. In the 19th century, it was quite customary for historians to interpret the Reformation largely in terms of its byproducts. By breaking up the monolithic Christendom, it was said Luther prepared the way for a pluralistic system, and this in turn prepared the way for toleration, for free speech, for democracy. It was said the Reformers laid the egg that the Puritans hatched in pushing early republicanism, and all of these byproducts of the Reformation were held up as the big thing. But it's quite clear that was not central for Luther, that it was his theological emphasis which was central to his whole message, and which is clearly the heart of the Reformation, because the Reformation was essentially a religious movement. And I think that the people very close to Luther really got it right. You can see this in Melanchthon's funeral oration for Luther, in which Melanchthon emphasized that Luther stood in a long line of prophets and evangelists and apostles. And then he mentions the great people in the history of the church, like St. Augustine and St. Bernard and others, and place Luther historically in that tradition. The other man who, at the time of Luther's death, assessed his importance was the local city preacher, Johannes Bugenhagen. He described Luther in these words. He said he was without doubt that angel of God of which the Apocalypse speaks in chapter 14, flying in mid-heaven with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth. This angel said, "Fear Lord, fear God, and give him the glory." Those are the two parts of Dr. Luther's teaching, the law and the gospel, through which all of scriptures are opened up and Christ is known as our righteousness and eternal life. Now, it seems to me that this really puts its finger on Luther's essential message and his real importance, and the way in which he himself really would have wanted to be understood as a churchman who was working within the boundary of the one church, the Una Sancta, for reform.
Could we go into the theological area for a couple of questions? First of all, why was Luther, or what was different about Luther's gospel from anybody else's of the 16th century or before?
I think probably clarity and the fact that that the scriptures were available, the new editions, and this concentration on the scriptures as the basic source. And Luther himself recognized that as an intellectual reflection of the achievement of the Renaissance, because the Renaissance had stressed this drive ad fontes, back to the fountains. And Luther described Renaissance humanism as a kind of John the Baptist, which preceded the coming of the Reformation, in which the gospel itself would be expressed most clearly, as in the coming of Christ himself, kind of second coming in the pure preaching of the gospel. Now, there had been many reform movements before Luther, and Luther himself said, "I, for my part, have two authorities. One, John Wycliffe, who was an English reformer who had criticized abuses and put out new theories of dominion and sovereignty and of Christian authority and all. And the other, he said, was Lorenzo Valla." Now, Lorenzo Valla was clearly one of the two most brilliant men of the century. The German philosopher Leibniz, in fact, said that Nicholas Cusanus, the Platonic philosopher, and Lorenzo Valla were the two most brilliant people of the Italian Renaissance. And Luther said, my other authority is Lorenzo Valla. And Valla had developed a very critical approach, a historical approach to documents, to historical documents. He had done annotations on the New Testament, which Luther's near predecessor, Erasmus, had used extensively in his own paraphrases on the New Testament. So I'd say one big advantage that Luther had was the intellectual work of the Renaissance. And Luther himself was a rationalist, a Christian rationalist, that he believed that reason was the most wonderful thing that God had ever made. So he approved of these cultural advances and these religious advances of the Renaissance. And then, of course, he had a second advantage, namely that the political power of the institutional church had weakened extensively due to the rise of the national monarchs and all, so that he had the protection of Frederick the Wise in the early stages, and the German Emperor Charles V was really unable to get at him. Luther, of course, viewed this all as providential, not as accidental, and believed that God, who wished this cause of the gospel to flourish at this time, had prepared the way, just as he had prepared the way for the coming of Christ with the great Pax Romana, established, the great peace established by the Roman Empire at the time of the coming of Christ.
Something that follows from that rather easily is Luther's view of the church itself. Now, obviously, because Luther became a reformer, and the other reformers at Wittenberg and his followers, they had a different view of what the church was than his Roman Catholic or Papist predecessors.
It's true. On the other hand, most historians tend to think of Luther as a schismatic who wanted to set up his own church and all. Luther always thought of the church as the one church. In the piece that he did, I believe it was 1537, on the councils and the church, he still talks about the church as the una sancta, as the one holy Catholic, that is to say, universal church. And he never thought of a Lutheran church. In fact, he opposed the notion of a separate church named after him, because he always felt that he was reforming at least a good segment of the one church. Now, the implications of his re-emphasis of the gospel for the institutional structure of the church were naturally pretty enormous, because it undercut the sacramental sacerdotal system. Probably the most radical thing he ever wrote was on the Babylonian captivity of the church in 1520, in which he discusses the way in which the sacraments were being more or less used as a power instrument, and that only two, the dominical sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper, were really and truly instituted by Christ and had both the word and the physical elements. And this very naturally changed the idea of the institutional structure of the church. But even there, as Veronica Wedgwood put it in her Velvet Studies, history played tricks on Luther. Luther wasn't able to establish the kind of church structure that he really wanted. And in fact, in a way, it was only in America, in a kind of free political situation, that it was possible for the Lutherans coming from Europe, such as Dr. Walther and the Saxons and the Missouri Synod immigrants, to more or less realize Luther's ideal of a congregational setup, which laymen and ministers really are of the same estate, even though they have different offices.
It's obvious that Martin Luther had a great impact on what later developed as the Lutheran Church. But in a perhaps the same sort of way, the confessional era that came toward the later years of Luther's life and started with the Augsburg Confession of 1530 and ended up with the publication of the Book of Concord in 1580, if I'm correct, have an equally large impact on what Lutheranism has later become. Would you say that Lutheranism is largely an outgrowth, or why we are Lutherans today is because of Martin Luther or because of the confessional era, or is that a unfair question to ask?
Well, it's a mighty big one for a limited time. I'd say two things in response to Doug. One is that I know it's sort of obvious to point to the, what is it, supposed to be some 90 million Lutherans throughout the world as sort of the child of Luther's reformatory efforts. That's only part of the picture, because if one reads on the relation, about the relation of Calvin to Luther, for example, Brian Gerrish up at the Divinity School at the University of Chicago has a really brilliant article. I believe it's in the Wilhelm Pauk Festschrift, a collection of articles in honor of that great Reformation scholar, Pauk. You can see the extent to which Calvin himself was attached to Luther and his debt to him and all. And there's a new emphasis in current scholarship on the extent to which Luther's ideas formed a theological base for the English Reformation. Thus, Starkey and Morrison and some of these young Tudor advisors to Henry VIII, it turns out now, had read Luther's commentaries and did translations of his commentaries and all. This is a fairly new development in scholarship. There's a scholar down at the University of California, Riverside, Sissy Bonini, who has a new study of Luther's influence on Morrison, for example. Well, that influence of Luther as reformer on other reformers is sort of paralleled by the influence of the Augsburg Confession on the other confessional positions. If, for example, you take the Westminster Confession, you can find amazing parallels and almost precise borrowings of phrases and all. For the evangelical emphasis, say, within Anglicanism, or in this country, Episcopalianism. So it's really hard to draw a line between the reformers, Luther and Calvin, and the confessional statements that emerged from their position. After all, in terms of the Augsburg Confession, Luther gave his complete support to this particular statement. And most of the confessional statements between 1530 and 1580 were elaborations, somewhat done in a polemical context. But then the creeds of the early church were also not to be expressions of the full content of the gospel or of the Christian religion, but were rather responses in this sense, to criticism in this sense, that they spelled out what could not be included as orthodox, that is to say, straight teaching. And therefore I think that that the effect of the confessions and of the reformers have to be sort of combined and assessed together in terms of their importance for the later Christian tradition.
To this very day, we, especially among the Lutheran community, constantly refer to Luther and to the confessions in the Book of Concord, especially the Augsburg Confession. And quite obviously, we still very much emphasize the gospel that Luther proclaimed in the 16th century. Is this still the very heart and soul of Lutheranism in our own 20th century? Or is there more that we've carried from Luther to the 20th century?
Well, I believe that it should be, and it clearly always isn't, because together with such theological interest and emphasis and the religious content that carries over, a great many other attitudes carry over that are historically conditioned, and that aren't necessarily a part of basic Lutheranism, which Luther would have wanted translated basic Christianity. You know, he really wanted all of his works destroyed so that people would read only the Bible and all. There's no doubt that many attitudes, postures, positions of Lutherans are historically conditioned. Well, that doesn't constitute a criticism on my part of traditional Lutheranism, because I think that also many Lutheran critics of traditional Lutheranism have been tremendously conditioned and have been conditioned by the 20th century, secular learning that's not really able to grasp the meaning of the gospel, by certain intellectual trends in the contemporary world and all that need to be resisted rather than complied with. So I concede and gladly that this theological tradition has in the course of time been conditioned, I'd broaden that and say so has just about every other position, whether it's pro or con, with regard to Luther's importance in history and his message.
Dr. Lewis W. Spitz, Jr., professor at Stanford University, has been our guest this afternoon on KFUO, and we've been talking a little bit about the Reformation on this, the 458th anniversary of the Reformation, the festival of the Reformation we're celebrating today.